You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. For journalist and essayist Chuck Klosterman, the sitcom Seinfeld is an excellent symbol of the 1990s. Maybe not the show itself, although there's a little truth there as well. But he writes about our reaction to Seinfeld, the most popular show on television in the 1990s, that even though the number of people who watched any random episode far exceeds the biggest hits today, if you missed an episode, you missed it. This was not something people worried about. And if you did care, you'd pretend you didn't. And Klosterman says that experience, an adversarial relationship with the unseemliness of trying too hard, ambivalence, was the mood of the decade. It was the last decade when personal and political engagement was optional. Now, today, in hindsight, it was a momentous decade where political, technological, and societal upheavals that have marked the past 20 years were being nurtured. And Klosterman explores these early stirrings along with the issues that did capture our attention in the 1990s, from politics, the technological boom of the decade, the music, the art, the pop culture, underground culture, the emerging cult of grievance, and the cult of celebrity in his series of essays, The 90s, a Book. Chuck Klosterman has written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, Esquire, Spin, and ESPN, to name a few. He's the author of 8 nonfiction books, including Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, and Killing Yourself to Live, 2 novels, and a short story collection. He served as the ethicist for The New York Times Magazine for 3 years, and he joins us today to talk about his book, The 90s, on Studio Tulsa. Chuck Klosterman, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to the program.
No, it's good to be here.
You know, the 1990s, at first thought, it was hard to remember exactly what actually happened then. And I think your book does talk a little bit about that, how we look at it in hindsight. But your book does remind us that, like every decade, a lot of things happened, and many of the events of the 90s have repercussions for us today. What were the questions you wanted to answer about the decade when you began writing this book?
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, because one thing I have found with writing a book about the 90s that was particularly complex is sort of the bifurcation in what the reader will remember about that period, kind of an all or nothing scenario. I mean, for a lot of people, I think the 90s seems very recent. Like, they can remember those details as if they had happened, you know, just weeks ago. There are other people born maybe into the 90s or afterwards who see the 90s no different than the moon landing. It's just like expository history that they never had an actual experience with. And then, of course, there are even older people who might look at the 90s as just one more chunk of time that doesn't seem that distant to them or different from the 70s, the 80s, and the time after that. So that was a complex thing. Like, how do you write a book for people who've had just diametrically different experiences with the same time frame? It might have almost been easier to write a book about the 1890s. I mean, in terms of, like, what questions was I trying to answer? This is not that kind of a book. Like, this is not a book where I'm trying to revise the way we currently think about the 90s, or sort of say to tell people, well, you believed this, but it's actually the complete opposite. My goal was to not look at this period the way we look at it through the lens of today, through like the prism of modernity, but to actually get back to the texture of the time, what it felt like to live through that period. So in some ways, the things about the 90s that are, I don't know, have almost become caricatures or cliches were somewhat partially true. And this book is more about sort of understanding why those things emerged, why those things became the way we remember a period of time.
As a person who grew up in the late 60s and 70s, I think of the 90s as a time of a collective relaxed sigh. For some many people, I think, maybe a majority of Americans, because, you know, there were certainly contretemps during the decade, but compared to the 60s and 70s, and to a lesser extent, the 80s, it just seemed a lot less stressful.
Well, you know, that's kind of true. I mean, the 90s were in some ways a lower stakes time period. I mean, you know, Clinton was president for 8 of those years, and he was a good president for good times. There was no hot war. There was no cold war. The economy was incrementally improving. A lot of the things that troubled people were about their own lives, kind of an interiority, where there wasn't this sense that like, well, I need to get out and sort of engage with culture because, you know, we must provide the resistance or whatever. We must, you know, like there's this cataclysmic event. Every election we have now is typically described as the most important election you will experience in your lifetime. This was very unlike, say, the 1996 election, where voter turnout was only 49%. And perhaps for the last time, voters were not reminded that this election was the most important act of their political life. So what you're remembering and what you're saying is true. I mean, it wasn't true in totality. And of course, it wasn't true for everybody. It wasn't like everybody had an easy life in the 90s, but the 90s were an easier time to live for most people.
Of course, you write that for the generation that was maturing at that time, it was a matter of not will I be able to have a home and family? It's will I sell out?
Yes, that was an issue that for a long time, you can go back to Bob Dylan and people accused him of selling out by going electric. It's not like it was invented by the 90s, but its apex was in the 90s. That was the time when the idea of commercialism was kind of perceived as like the biggest social problem in the world of the arts. And the fear was that if you commodify your art in any way and try to make it appeal to people who aren't exactly like you, you are compromising your integrity. Now, today, if you meet a young person and you try to explain selling out to them, it makes no sense whatsoever. If you had tried in 2010, it would have made sense, but it would have seemed very antiquated. It's really only the 90s where it was assumed to be the central issue for an artist. I mean, you look at a band like Nirvana. Their whole aesthetic was based around their discomfort with success and that they were humiliated by the fact that they were also the biggest band in the world. These are very alien concepts that only apply to one period of time, and it's this middle part of the 90s.
And then you had other bands that were like them who also rebelled against that notion of popularity, and all that did would make them more popular.
Well, I mean, it is interesting. You look at a band like Pearl Jam, right? Yes. They sue Ticketmaster, which undercuts their ability to tour. They stop making videos because they did not like the reaction to the video for Jeremy. They start putting songs on their albums that are consciously inaccessible, that like are conscious attempts to stop a very casual person from appreciating it. And yet they still did retain a massive amount of popularity. It was like, you know, you can't convince people that you're not popular if they like you. Like you can't convince people you are popular if you're not, but you also can't convince people you're not popular if you are.
Well, let me ask about how you define the 90s, because in the book you look at the 90s as from the end of the Cold War to 9/11. What do these two events tell us about the decade in between?
Well, okay, that's that framing device, the Cold War to 9/11, that's actually become the conventional way to describe the 90s and to frame the 90s. I don't really see it in that way. I see the 90s actually starting in 91. Granted, the Berlin Wall fell in 89, but then 1990 was, to a degree, the 80s on autopilot. A lot of the things that we associate with the 80s were still very much present in the year 1990. I mean, for example, like Twin Peaks comes out that year. That seems like a real new idea, but that was a fringe interest. Cheers was still the most popular show. Joe Montana was still the best player in the NFL. People were still shopping in catalogs, you know, and like ordering things at Christmas that came 6 to 8 weeks later. You know, New Kids on the Block had a huge tour. It wasn't until 91 where we start to see the shift of the kind of the qualities of the 90s, the things that we talk about now, almost like, oh, if someone threw a 90s party, how you would dress, what you would complain about, the kind of jokes you would make. That really begins in 91 and then sort of ends after 9/11, when there was this cataclysmic event that shifted people in a way that they didn't fully shift back. If they did, they almost overcompensated. I suppose if it was your question sort of like, what is the central quality of the 90s? I suppose it would be not just ambivalence, but the ability to be ambivalent and not be seen as hedging. It wasn't problematic not to pick a side. You didn't have to pick a side. You could just be yourself.
My guest today is Chuck Klosterman, author, essayist, and commenter on pop culture. His new book is titled The 90s, A Book. It's published by Penguin Press. Well, perhaps one of the most important events was the emergence of digital culture, and that happened in the 90s. It was clearly, as you write, a before and after moment in human culture. And you run through a myriad of changes that we all take for granted, like how we contact a friend or coworker, catching up with an old friend. We wrote a letter before then, waiting for information, interesting privacy rights. You know, you talk about doxing and how we were all scared of doxing, but, you know, before the digital culture, we had a phone book that had everyone's address and telephone number right there for anyone to see.
Yeah, it's hard to fully understand that. And what it really does is it illustrates how there was an intangible way to the way people viewed the world because of the internet. In 1992, not only was your name and address in the phone book, you had to pay money to keep it out of it. If you actually did not want to have a listed number, it was just assumed that everybody would do that. If you called the operator and you knew the spelling of the last name of a person and had a sense of what area code they lived in, you would be connected by this person. You know, this idea of doxing now is almost seen as kind of a sort of emotional violence, that exposing who somebody is and where they live and who they are in reality. It's just this kind of thinkable act. And what it shows is that people now have, without even trying, have become very comfortable with the idea that they have two selves. They have a self that exists online and a self that exists in their home. And somehow this chasm cannot be connected by anybody except the user themselves. Now, why did this thinking change? Well, you can come up with 100 reasons, but the main one is technology. I mean, technology shifts the way people feel about the world, and it shifts the way they feel about themselves. And you look at, you know, we start the 90s, no one has the internet. It's not even really an idea outside of anyone who's not a computer scientist. Post 9/11, it's so central in our life that it's hard to have an office job with, you know, if your internet goes down, the workday is over. That's a short window of time, right? We're talking this full change happens in maybe 8 years, maybe for some it was 3, maybe for some it was 12. But look at the Industrial Revolution. That took decades. I mean, the changes that happened in the 90s not only were profound, but fast.
Very fast. And it also sort of contributes to an overall speeding up of, I don't want to call it time, but it really is kind of like time. Everything happens in a more compressed rate than, say, before technology and the digital revolution. Okay,
but here's the interesting twist, though, and this is the thing that is, I'm glad you brought this up, to me, in many ways, the most interesting part of the 90s. Throughout the 20th century, particularly after World War II, one of the things you often talked about in media is the idea of an accelerating culture. I used to write about the acceleration of culture constantly in the 90s when I was a newspaper writer. The book Generation X, the subtitle is Tales from an Accelerated Culture. It was assumed that the internet would be the ultimate accelerant, because it just seemed almost built for that purpose. And yet it has been, to a degree, a decelerant. We've now kind of moved into a perpetual now, because we have access to all of time equally. You know, like for so long, time had moved kind of like a linear road. You moved along this road, the scenery changed as you moved alongside of it. If you wanted to go back, you had to stop and, you know, literally move back through time to get back to something that had happened 7 years ago, a trend that was now gone. But now it's like, instead of a road, we live in a kind of a vast, shallow ocean of information where you can wade anywhere in and get whatever you need with a bucket. And it has changed our experience of moving through time. This is a theory that a guy named Mark Fisher, kind of a British, I guess he was like a rock critic and also an anti-capitalist guy. It's called the slow cancellation of the future. And it is why, in many ways, I think that the 90s are not just the last decade of the 20th century, but maybe the last decade that is going to exist, at least in the way that we used to use that term. I mean, there'll always be 10-year increments of time. That's the technical definition. But this idea that a period of time has kind of a kind of immutable, separate texture, that seems to be maybe disappearing. And there are many examples of this in culture. Really, the only thing that isn't an example is politics. Politics are still kind of moving ahead in the same way, changing in the same speed. But the cultural experience seems to be somewhat in a bit of a stasis, that things have slowed down and we're not going to forget things the way we used to forget things.
Give us an example of what you mean by that decelerant of time.
Let's say we took a footage of an obscure television show from 1965, and then we found another obscure television show from 1980, okay? So the actors aren't famous, the shows aren't very popular, and you show them to someone, maybe even a young person, and you say, which of these came first? It would be very easy for that person to recognize which one came from 1965. The way people look, the way people talk, the way it is shot, the way the story is told, everything about its aesthetics would make it very clear that this one predated the other by 15 years. If you do the same with a show from 2005 and 2020, it's almost impossible. I mean, like the visuals are kind of the same. If someone's not using a smartphone, there's no sense that things have changed technologically. There's no sense of fashion being this radical thing or their hair. Like you look at like, say the characters on Friends in the 90s, you can kind of look at Friends and you can see their hair and you can see their clothes and you can see how that was different from both the 80s and the time that came later. Now, culture continues to evolve and change. It's not like everything is exactly the same, but it's almost like they're just cards being shuffled, that a song from 2004 and a song from 2017 could easily be swapped and no one would notice. Like there would be a sense that the way you consumed art in 2004 and 2017 was weirdly similar. Whereas if you took the music from 1991, say you took Nirvana and the Red Hot Chili Peppers and some hip hop records and you moved them back to 1971 and played them for somebody who loves music, they would say, this seems dissident. This doesn't even seem like music. I don't understand how this is recorded. I've never heard guitars this crisp. What are the lyrics? Like we're moving into this phase where because we have access to all time, everything is to some degree retro. And anybody who's creating new art is not just playing off of the last thing that was popular, but all things that have ever been popular, and perhaps more meaningfully, all things that used to be obscure. And it has caused sort of a, like, not necessarily a negative, but a strange shift in how we experience time.
Well, one way we have experienced time during the 1990s that certainly changed during that decade was the 24-hour news cycle. And our initial impressions of events we were seeing in real time shaped our understanding. And you have a number of examples in the book from the Rodney King beating and riots after the acquittal of the officers, Columbine massacre, the Oklahoma City bombing, O.J. Simpson, this incessant fear of crime in the 1990s, even as crime rates were just falling through the floor. You know, there's this perception and then reality. And oftentimes our reality was shaped by the initial impressions we saw as these events took place live or in the immediacy of the day.
Well, I mean, what you're describing in many ways was a kind of a buzzword of the 90s, which is sort of the dominance of postmodernism, where the perception of an event and the event became interchangeable. One of the things that was shifted by the way news coverage changed, the 24-hour news cycle, as you say, is that there's now an expectation, and you kind of see this starting with the Gulf War in 91, that people expect to be informed of events as they're literally happening, that there will be no sort of gap between the event itself and their understanding of it. The problem being, of course, that the first telling of history through journalism is inevitably wrong. Not because of anyone's fault, but that's just because the way it works. I mean, when you have a limited amount of data and you present it as the full picture, it's going to be a distorted picture. And we've almost got kind of moved to this phase where we aren't even really that troubled by it, that we see a lot of the information we take in as just something that can be slotted into whatever our kind of political or worldview or ideology that pre-exists is. So it's just a different thing. I mean, like we have more content now, we have more data and we have more news. I don't know if people feel like they're necessarily more informed, certainly not better informed. I mean, you can give people information and still heighten their confusion, which you see through the events you mentioned in the 90s. And now it's just sort of become the way all media works.
It's also interesting. You write about that period. This was also a heyday for metropolitan papers and glossy magazines, perhaps. For magazines, it was their final heyday, and TV journalism at that time, it was all presented, but none of it was saved. It was, you know, magazines thrown out. Television journalism of the time was taped over and reused because the cost of storage was so prohibitive. It was almost a time of, you see this in its initial phase, and then it disappears. You write quite eloquently about that.
It's something that was invisible at the time, but seems meaningful now, which is that the access to information we had in the 90s and our ability to almost see everything that was happening that was noteworthy, because of the expansion of just like video recording as opposed to film and the rise in media and all of these things. That had been unprecedented. It had never been like that in the past. So you could see anything. And yet it was not cataloged the way things are now because of the internet. You saw something and it disappeared. Like, I use this example many times in the book and in life, but I think it's just really sort of consequential. So like when Game of Thrones had its finale, it was huge news. You would see it on the front page of like the Washington Post and the New York Times. It was covered incessantly as if this was something that all people were interested in simultaneously. And yet the number of people who watched any random episode of Seinfeld or any random episode of Friends, there were more people viewing those kind of throwaway shows than the number of people who watched the Game of Thrones finale. Any television show, because of the way television was constituted at the time, was more popular than what is seen as the most popular shows of today. And yet, despite that widespread sort of monocultural universality, these shows were seen as less important. If you missed an episode of Seinfeld, you just missed it. You know, you watched it when it was shown again in the summer, and that was kind of it. Like, you were more likely to say you didn't watch TV at all than you were to say, oh, you know, this is appointment television, or like the idea of prestige TV, a common term now, that would have been seen as laughable early in the 90s. The idea that TV could be on par with film or whatever. It was a time when you could see anything, and yet if you didn't, it mattered less. And I think that's a hard idea sometimes to illustrate to people who didn't experience it. Although I'm guessing a lot of people who did experience it and listening to this interview know exactly what I mean.
Right. My guest today is Chuck Klosterman, an author, essayist, and commenter on pop culture. His new book is titled The 90s, A Book. It's published by Penguin Press, featuring essays about the decade in every aspect of pop culture, politics, and more. One of the things I really enjoyed on the journey of the book was you spend time on what, at first glance today, are niche figures. But when you investigate them further, they do have some sort of repercussions for today. And the first one you spend quite a bit of time on is H. Ross Perot, the third party candidate in 1992 and 1996. And if you ask people who were, you know, voting at that time, they would say, yeah, Perot was the reason George H.W. Bush lost to Bill Clinton. Now, when you look at the statistics, that doesn't seem to be the case. But the influence of that third-party run and what it did to the president's party at that time has been massively influential, you argue.
Yes. So you're, it's absolutely true. If you ask someone now about H. Ross Perot, they may only know of him because, you know, he died relatively recently. If you ask a young person, for example, what percentage of the popular vote do you think H. Ross Perot got in 1992? They will somewhat justifiably guess 5%, 4%, but it was 19%. It was almost one out of every five voters was voting for this third party candidate. Now, you're right. Mechanically, when we break down what the exit poll data suggests, it would have been of that 19%, 9.5% would have voted for Clinton and 9.5% would have voted for Bush is what the statistics tell us. So it's like, well, it was a push and it wouldn't have mattered anyways. You know, if anything, all it really did was maybe lower Clinton's victory in the popular vote. And yet the comparison I kind of use is the 2 years that Michael Jordan quit playing for the Chicago Bulls and played baseball and the Houston Rockets won the NBA title during those two seasons. You could make the argument that they were going to win those titles anyways. They had had success against Jordan's Bulls, and if he'd played, maybe everything would be exactly the same. But no one really believes that. Everyone believes that the way the NBA seasons would have worked and unspooled would have been different if Jordan is there. And in the same way, it is almost impossible to imagine that 1992 election without Perot in it. Because if he's not in it, everything changes. Then, you know, I mean, part of the reason Bill Clinton was, they ran him for president, was they thought, well, we have no chance to beat Bush. He's so popular. The Berlin Wall has just fallen. Communism is over. Everything. He won the Gulf War. He created the coalition. He's just this unbeatable person. And then you get these three candidates, one of which is aggressively anti-Bush. I mean, this is what I'm talking about, Perot. It's like he's nipping at Bush much more than he's going after Clinton. It allows Clinton to sort of be the charming optimist that we kind of see, think of him as in that early period of his career. So, you know, in some ways, Perot's just like a triviality. Oh, this interesting third-party candidate who did pretty well and, you know, came from Texas and had this funny way of speaking. But you could argue that his entry in that race has probably had more consequence politically than almost anything else over the last 40 years. Because if he doesn't run, then Bush probably does win that election. And then he's a, then we have 16 years of the Republicans. The Democrats have to completely reinvent themselves. There's no Republican revolution led by Newt Gingrich because there doesn't need to be. So a lot of the anger and vitriol that we see in this partisan way may not be as present. I mean, you look back on stuff like that and you're like, well, part of me just thinks it's interesting, but another part of me thinks it's profound.
And yeah, I think of Newt Gingrich as being that figure that has led to this intense partisan posturing we have today, where we have a red America and a blue America. But, you know, that was going on during Bush's reelection campaign in 92. You had Pat Buchanan giving this famous speech that Molly Ivan said it sounded better in the original German. And that party was already at war with itself in 1992. So that was going on.
I mean, yeah, like Buchanan's a paleoconservative, right? So he's got these ideas of being a conservative that predate almost any sort of person actively involved with politics now. And that would have seen as just the term paleoconservative, a dinosaur type idea, okay? But when Clinton then becomes president, it creates this opening, because even though in almost any context, like, Clinton is a centrist, he's a pragmatist, he is not he's always trying to move his position closer to the middle, but because he seemed young and he spoke in a way that seemed to represent what was seen as sort of a liberal undercurrent or a progressive attempt to change America, it set the stage for someone like Newt Gingrich to build an entire Republican sort of platform. All of their talking points were around this idea of what they could make Clinton seem to represent. It was like the thing you said earlier about the difference between perception and reality. They were able to create a perception of Clinton that did become his reality.
You also write about Art Bell, the late night radio host. And I think when people think about Art Bell, they think of, okay, there is the sort of grain of this now more mainstream notion of conspiracy theories being, you know, valid. But you write, X-Files perhaps had more influence.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing about Art Bell was it was seen as amusing to people who were not full-on conspiracy theorists or people who only sort of dabbled in that world. You didn't look at the callers on the Art Bell show and say, like, this guy's making a great point. But then a TV show like The X-Files did accidentally, perhaps, something that might be more critical. David Duchovny's character was a conspiracy theorist, but he was good looking and charming, and he seemed reasonable. He seemed just like a guy asking questions. And it sort of created this idea that to be a conspiracy theorist, you didn't have to be the kind of person who called into Art Bell and claimed that there was an alien like living in your garage. You could just be somebody who seemed in so many ways likable and charming and just smart. I think in a lot of ways, The X-Files did mainstream the idea of the casual conspiracy theorist.
Well, there is so much to take apart in this book, everything from Seinfeld and, you know, a television show about nothing and how that defined the decade to everything having to do with our technological revolution of the 90s, music, just about every part of the culture. The name of the book is The 90s, a Book. Chuck Klosterman, it's such a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot, man. Bye-bye.
Journalist, author, essayist, and commentator on pop culture, Chuck Klosterman, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new book is titled The 90s, a Book. It's published by Penguin Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.